All right, let's start the meeting today dealing with the two women that we had talked about the last time we were together. I told you I was going to talk about the woman of service was Tabitha or Dorcas, and then today we're going to deal with the two women, hopefully we can get two women dealt with, Deborah and Jael, the women of wisdom and courage in the book of Judges. We're going to do a little background here, hopefully. Let me grab this one. I wanted to show you this map so you can understand what we're talking about. And hopefully you've read all the background, so I'm just going to jump from chapter to chapter giving you an overview. But primarily Deborah and Jael are dealt with in Judges 4 and 5. Deborah herself is an anomaly, since in the normal biblical order, men have the places of leadership reserved for them, whether it be in the home, on the throne, or on the battlefield. But for 20 years, the land of Israel had been oppressed by Jabin, the king of the Canaanites, and his 900 chariots of iron. Sisera, the captain of the Canaanite army, had brought such great oppression that the people of Israel had cried out to the Lord for help. And we're studying in school, are we not, Elena? That's what the whole book of Judges is about. The people obey God, the judge dies, they disobey God. Then they cry out, God raises up a judge, he delivers them, they stay in obedience to the Lord until that judge dies, and then they disobey again. So we see in Judges chapter 1 that Canaan was the ancient name of the country of Phoenicia, there in the area that we call Palestine. It was the ancient name of the country of Palestine. The whole area, this whole area here on the map, was called Palestine in those days. And then Canaan was the Hebrew name for the people, meaning red, purple. Now, the Canaanites were also known as the Phoenicians, because if you can see the map, there's not too much glare. They primarily were concentrated right up along this strip here, and then across this northern part up here in what was the inheritance of Zebulun, Naphtali, Issachar, and Asher. And then down this way, they stretched up the coast through the Judah, Dan, and up into Manasseh. And the Phoenicians, of course, were the people who dyed cloth purple. They made purple dye, and they got very rich. They were sailors. They had a little strip here and of land, and they spent a great deal of the time in trade on the seacoast around the Mediterranean, and they became very wealthy. The Phoenicians developed coins and so forth for trade. They were not a backward people. They were very advanced, but they were very pagan. So Israel then, when they went in, they were to drive out all the people who had been settled in Canaan or Palestine, all this area. That was their mandate, their objective. But Israel had fought against the Canaanites, and they had secured their inheritance down here at Hebron, which is Jerusalem, in this area here where Judah was concentrated. You remember Caleb? Caleb said, give me that mountain. That was Hebron in this area here. That was their inheritance. And they had driven the Canaanites out there, but they did not drive the Canaanites out of the valley area because the Canaanites had chariots of iron, we see in Judges 1:19. Again in verse 28 of chapter 1, we find that Israel became strong, but they still did not drive the Canaanites out of the land, but rather they made them pay tribute to Israel. So why did they stop fighting? Were they weary of fighting? Or, like their ancestors before them, were they fearful and unbelieving that the Lord was able to overcome chariots of iron? Dr. Gill attributed their failure to greed and covetousness, and a love of ease, in that they did not want to go to the trouble of expelling the Canaanites. Matthew Henry commented that they did not have the fear and the dread of the pagan idolatry. And they were foolish enough to believe that they could live among them without danger. I think that has a lot of merit to it. You think I remember in my lifetime things that I would have been, I couldn't believe, I would have been overcome to see being done in public now that people walk by and act like they don't even see it. I remember when I was with my youngest son in Germany, some of the billboards had just outright nudity. But the people had become desensitized to it. We couldn't have coped with it in America at that time. But you see it long enough and brought before your eyes constantly, you get desensitized to it, and you don't really think it's all that bad. I remember when unmarried people lived together. We thought it was horrible. It was something that you never did, but now we don't even think about it. Even among church people, we don't even think about it. And so here we have Israel. They did not think that the Canaanites were all that bad. And so they didn't think it was that necessary to drive them out. Rather than purging ourselves from our besetting sins, we also, like Israel, often grow strong enough or weary or satisfied enough to consider that these sins can be controlled. And so just like Israel, those sins instead grow strong enough to overtake us and put us back into bondage. Sin rides in chariots of iron and is a cruel taskmaster. Israel should never have allowed themselves to have been confronted or comforted by the notion that these Canaanites, already empowered with chariots of iron, would ever be satisfied paying tribute to the invader Israelites. You have to remember that according to the Canaanites, the Israelites were invading their land. And how could they be so strong that they had 900 chariots of iron? You have to understand, in these days, chariots were expensive. And that was a token, an emblem of their strength. And why would they be happy paying tribute to these invader Israelites? Remember, the Canaanites considered the land to be rightfully theirs, as we said. And so our sin nature wrongfully supposes that it has the first and the rightful place in our lives. It's the first master. Even though it appears to be subdued from time to time, it is always in rebellion to the true king. That's why Paul warned the Galatians to put on the whole armor of God. We're in a war, but we're more than conquerors through Christ. Sadly, there will be battles of triumph for our enemy as long as we dwell in this corrupt nature. Paul confessed to the Romans that he warred within himself and that he did what he did not want to do, and he did not do what he should do. We find that in Romans 7, and in verse 24 he said, "O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from the body of this death?" But war and fight and stand we must until we're translated from this earthly body to the glorified body. Now, if we move over to Judges chapter 2, just by way of a brief summary, we're going to see here that Israel served the Lord, as we had said, while Joshua lived and all of those of his generation. But then they turned to Baal and they behaved like the pagan nations around them. So the Lord sent all the pagan people, the Midianites, the Philistines, the Canaanites, and all those who had lived in that area to rule over Israel. And then Israel would cry out under the oppression, and the Lord would send a judge to deliver them. As long as the judge lived, as we said earlier, then Israel would live in peace and serve the Lord. How does that apply to us? Well, do we find it possible to live in peaceful obedience and submission to the Lord only when we're being watched? Is it relatively easy to be free from those pesky sins, such as murmuring, pouting, self-indulgence, pride, self-pity, laziness, and such like, only when the Lord has provided us with a comfortable environment in which to be obedient. Perhaps some of our little rascal sins also require the oversight of others, or else we'll find ourselves succumbing. This failure, of course, can be excused just as neatly as Israel excused theirs. We just can't do the same things that others can do. We're not strong. And it's okay, though, because we're doing the best we can. After all, Israel couldn't drive out the Canaanites because they had chariots of iron. And then we go over to chapter 3. Here we're told that these pagan nations were left in the promised land to prove Israel, to test them, to try, to not to tempt them, but to prove them. We read in verse 2 that the younger generations now living in Israel had not known warfare. They didn't understand what their fathers had done to secure that land. They would grow into adults. They would benefit from the warfare of their parents. But they would not participate in it. They would have no blood on their hands. So the Lord left these pagans in the land to prove Israel and to require them to remain vigilant in learning and in the use of the art of warfare. In Judges 3:4, we explains that the Lord was going to use these pagan nations to prove Israel, to learn whether Israel would obey His commandments, which He had given to their fathers and grandfathers. So likewise, our salvation gives us hearts of flesh, but not glorified bodies yet. We must remain here and fight the good fight and progress through the Lord's work of sanctification in us. He's proving us just as He did Israel. Do we love Him? Can we remember what He's done for us? He's provided us with weapons of warfare. We will remain fit and sharp and wise if we use them. But Israel, as so often is the case, when one generation inherits without price, Israel got comfortable and they intermarried with the pagans and they forgot the God of their fathers. And we will find in verses 6 through 8, so begins the unfolding of the repetitions of the judges. Israel sins and forgets God. God sends a nation to overrun Israel. Israel cries out under the oppression. The Lord sends a judge to deliver them. They remain faithful only as long as that judge lives. Matthew Henry commented that Israel's punishment was to spare the Canaanites so that, I like this, Israel was beaten with their own rod. Israel, he said, had indulged the Canaanites and grown familiar with them. And so, to quote Matthew Henry, if they will have such inmates as these among them, let them take them and see what will become of it. Thus men cherish and indulge their own corrupt appetites and passions instead of mortifying them and make provision for them, and therefore God justly leaves them to themselves under the power of their sin, which will be their ruin. Haven't we all wanted something so badly, and when we got it, it actually was bad for us? We too, then, must be careful that we are not entertaining our sin and becoming so familiar with it that we're comfortable having it around. Then we move to Judges chapter 4. And so it goes that we are introduced here now to the events that will be unfolded in the chapters of 4 and 5. We meet, of course, the Canaanites and their chariots of iron again. They've turned the tables on Israel and are no longer in servitude, but they put Israel into bondage. 20 years of oppression have passed, and the Lord has not raised up a man to deliver Israel. But we meet Deborah. We see in Judges chapter 4 and verse 4, and Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, she judged Israel at that time. And she dwelt under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in Mount Ephraim, and the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. So we find then that Deborah is a prophetess. It seems somehow easier to cry out for deliverance and to find strength in the Lord when the oppression seems to come from without. The Canaanites were out there oppressing Israel. But when we find that the cause of our misery and our oppression is due to our own stubbornness, hard-headedness, strong will, so forth, the realization can plummet us into a depth that will paralyze and engulf us. We may even have a difficult time accepting that God's Word any longer applies to us. And this may be the account for the current situation in Deborah's day. You remember, Israel could reflect on how the Canaanites got to be where they were. Israel hadn't obeyed the Lord. Israel had allowed it. Not only had they allowed it, they had entertained the Canaanites. And now, maybe there was a sense of despair and hopelessness. We find that in our world today, don't we? Nobody wants to allow a God, and nobody wants to can give an account for all the wickedness of men. Therefore, the only thing left to do is despair. So the men of Deborah's day were not willing to take the risk that would be involved to lead. Can you just imagine if you step forward to be a leader, what could happen to you? The Canaanites were all up the coast, all across here. They were everywhere. After all, the Canaanites had lived in Israel's valley. And so the Israelites had intermarried with them. And now there were an untold number of half-breeds in Israel. Who could fight against their own kin? I love Bunyan in The Holy War. He described the intermarriage of the Diabolonians and the Mansoulians as creating bad children. To quote Mr. Bunyan, Wilby Will had a deputy working for him whose name was Mr. Affection. This man was so corrupt that he was completely ruled by a sinful nature, and therefore they called him Vile Affection. Now, he and Carnal Lust, the daughter of Mr. Mind, were married. They had 3 sons and 3 daughters. All the children were married and lived in the town and had many bad brats, too many to name here. And then Mr. Bunyan describes later in the book, Now you may remember that I told you before that even after Emmanuel had remodeled man's soul, many Diabolonians had remained inside the town. Some had come with Diabolus when he took over the town, but because of unlawful marriages, some had been born in the town and still live there. And so we see the plight of Israel with the Canaanites. Now, Deborah is not the first woman in the Scriptures to have a more prominent and public role. Huldah is in 2 Kings 22:14, and she's introduced as a prophetess, as Deborah was called. Hilkiah the priest, along with the scribes, consulted Huldah on matters of the Scriptures on behalf of the king. These men should have known the meaning of the word that had been entrusted their oversight, but you remember, this was at the conclusion of a period of great falling away on the part of Judah. Then we find that Esther, in the time of the captivity, was elevated to the throne. Prior to her crowning, she did all the bidding of Mordecai in obedience, and she should have. But at this request, the request that he had for her to do something when he found out about the plot of Haman, she ordered the events that brought down Haman and saved her people. God had put her in a pivotal position with great influence, even under a Persian king. So we see then that we have some examples to prove that women can take over if necessary. Don't you like that terminology? I see some smiles. But these do not provide examples for us to hold up as justifications for overstepping the God-ordained parameters for our service. How many times have you been told as by way of justification that Deborah's the example? Women can be the president, women can lead because Deborah did. These are simply instances to show how far removed God's own people can be from Him, and how that turning away can cause widespread ignorance, which in turn breeds fear and wrong action or no action at all among those who are appointed to lead. Where are the men? That's a good question. These women that we've named were used to show the disparity of Israel's sin and as a mirror to focus their attention on the wages of their choices. Listen to what Isaiah said to Israel in Isaiah 3:11 to 12. This was a warning. Woe unto the wicked, he said. It shall be ill with him, for the reward of his hand shall be given him. That's perfectly right. But listen to what he says to Israel. As for my people, children are their oppressors and women rule over them. So we're not finding when women are in ruling that we have a wonderful situation in which everyone is right with the Lord. So we're introduced then in this terrible time for Israel, we're introduced to Deborah the prophetess. She lived in the area about 12 miles north of Jerusalem and in an inheritance belonging to the tribe of Ephraim. Now in chapter 1 we learned that this area was the inheritance of the son of Joseph and that they had driven out the Jebusites, and a particular city was named that the Jebusites had called Luz, L-U-Z, but they had renamed it Bethel, and that means the house of God. And this is where Deborah lived and received visitors under a palm tree. And there she judged their cases. So we can assume then from verse 5 that she was fulfilling the office of the judge at this time. Then in verse 6 we find that she called for Barak. Now Barak lived up north, up here in the inheritance of Naphtali. She was down here. And Ephraim, he was up in this area. He was from Kadesh Naphtali, one of the cities of refuge that we studied about. And she commissioned him to muster an army of 10,000 men made up of the two northern tribes of Naphtali and Zebulun. Probably because this was the area of the greatest concentration of the Canaanites. And so they were the two tribes who were the most hard-pressed by these pagans. This was given as a commandment of the Lord, meaning that Barak had no choice. If he regarded Deborah as a prophetess, then he was to regard this as the Lord's command. The Lord's promise, according as Deborah gave it to Barak, was that he was to muster these men and that he, the Lord, would draw out Jabin's army and all of his pesky iron chariots to the river Kishon at the foot of Mount Tabor, and he would deliver them into Barak's hand. Now, he doesn't say how he's going to deliver them. He just says that he'll deliver them. Next, I love this. We're going to read Barak's classic response, and I'm going to read that to you in verse 8. This is classic. He says, "And Barak said unto her, If thou wilt go with me, then I will go. But if thou wilt not go with me, then I will not go." How interesting. Well, he said he would not go. Before we're too hard on Barak, let's cast back into our own memories for the times when we've entered into negotiations with the Lord. Oh, says Barak. Here's his classic if-then conditional response. This is what you're going to learn in logic. If-then. If you do this, then I'll do that. If you go with me, I'll go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go. Poor Barak. 20 years is a long time to put up with the Canaanites and their iron chariots. He might be uncomfortable now, but he's still alive. He couldn't even bear to think what would happen to him if Jabin got a hold of him. Besides, how could he persuade 10,000 men to assemble against the Canaanites? Remember, the Canaanites had iron chariots. Haven't we been there? I'll do this, Lord, if you will do that. And even then, in the middle of our negotiations, we don't remember the Lord's ability, and we doubt His willingness to keep our bargain. Well, I know the Lord's able, I just don't know if He's willing. Now, what that actually means, here's the interpretation. I don't know for sure if the Lord is on board with my plan. Now, it's right here in this uneasy spot that we begin to consider who the Lord is. He doesn't say to us that He loves us and trusts us so much, and we're old enough now, so just go live for the Lord and He'll support us in whatever we decide. Have you heard that before? No. He reminds us that He is the King of Kings, which means that even though He is our Heavenly Father, He still commands and we must obey. And verse 6 is clear that the Lord commanded Barak to gather the army and go to the river. It was upon the obedience of this commandment that the promises of God would be realized. Israel would be delivered in their obedience. But Barak responded, "I will not go." Things might not be what they used to be, but if the Canaanites got riled up, things would certainly no longer be what they are. Barak was uncomfortable with his current level of obedience, and he was in no mood to have the equilibrium upset. He obviously wasn't denying that God existed, because his deal-making actually recognized that Israel had a God who was not one of the pagan gods. But perhaps he felt the hopelessness of their predicament. Like we said, many in our postmodern world, what do they have to turn to but hopelessness? It would be better for him if he could simply go on serving both the Lord and the Canaanites, right? He was safe, or at least he felt safe. He was secure, at least he felt that way. And he was relatively comfortable considering the circumstances. The Lord just always comes in, doesn't He, and upsets our equilibrium. But Deborah replied that she would go. But Barak's conditional obedience would exact the cost. The victory would have elevated him. As the captain of the army, he would have been the conqueror of Jabin and Sisera, and the deliverer and the rightful heir of the spoils of war. But now, the mighty Sisera would be killed by a woman. It's possible that Barak did not set a great deal in store by this consequence, given what he may have considered to be the impossibility of the task. Oh, yeah, right. We've got to get through the war first. Where's the Lord going to get a woman to kill Sisera? I've got to find him. Besides, he may have been working like some of us, like Esau. I just got to get the army together first, then I have to get to the river, then the next step, and then the next step, one day at a time. He'll worry about the consequences later. You remember, Esau was so hungry, he didn't care what it took to get something to eat right now. Besides, Barak might not have anything to worry about at all if the 900 iron chariots get sent out. But we read that Deborah is there at Kadesh with the army in verses 9 through 10. Now, verse 11 kind of breaks in like a parenthetical. It says, "Now Heber the Kenite, which was of the children of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, had severed himself from the Kenites and pitched his tent unto the plain of Zaanaim, which is by Kadesh," or Kadesh. Here we are introduced to Heber the Kenite. He's a descendant of the Midianite man named Cain, of the children of Hobab, who was the brother-in-law of Moses. We met him back in Exodus 18:27 and again in Numbers 10:32. We find out that Jethro, the father-in-law of Moses, returned to Midian, but Moses asked Hobab to stay and guide them into Israel. So Heber is one of Hobab's descendants, and these people moved around, and they lived in tents. They moved from place to place, and they were residing in the wilderness of Hebron, and then also up in the north area that belonged to the tribe of Naphtali. And so Heber, as this verse tells us, had removed himself from the main grouping of his people and had pitched his tent near Mount Tabor, right here. So he's up in here in this area. He's actually pitched in between where Sisera is going to come and Barak is supposed to take his army. Now, as the Lord had promised, he discomfited, or he frightened, the Canaanites. And it's interesting because Sisera, in verse 15, lighted down off his chariot and fled away on his feet. My, he had the chariot of iron, didn't he? He got out of his chariot and ran and left his troops to defend themselves. And again, if you'll remember in Holy War, Bunyan talked about Diabolus fleeing and leaving the men out there to fight for themselves. But Sisera came upon the tent of Heber, whom he had supposed to be an ally of Jabin, or at least neutral. And there was Jael, the wife of Heber, home alone and standing in the tent door. So when she saw Sisera coming toward her tent, she showed him hospitality and invited him in. And he asked her for a drink of water, but she gave him milk. And then she gave him a covering. He was all tired out from his run, and he was feeling safe enough, so he lay down to rest, instructing her to stand in the tent door and to tell a lie if anyone came asking for him. And she allowed him to fall fast asleep. Then she took a tent stake and a hammer, and you know, she hammered the stake through his temples and fastened his head to the ground. And then, as expected, along came Barak. Jael went out to meet him and invited him to see the man that he was pursuing. Barak must have remembered Deborah's words when he stood there looking at the dead Sisera. Who could have dreamed that the events of the battle would have turned out this way? But the Lord had said that Sisera would fall to a woman. And Jael hadn't even had to leave home. Now, Jael is criticized by many commentators as grossly violating the rules of hospitality for that part of the world. She's accused of trickery and treachery towards Sisera that are inexcusable. Some allow that Deborah sang Jael's praises because, quote, all is fair in love and war. But again, we must remember that Jael was alone in the middle of two warring armies, one of which, I might remind you, had 900 chariots of iron. No doubt she knew Sisera because she met Barak and told him she had the man he wanted. But what should she really have done? In Deborah's song of victory, Jael is praised as being blessed above all women in Judges 5:24-27. Dr. Gill says, this action is not otherwise to be justified but by its being done through an impulse of the Spirit of God upon her to take away the life of an implacable enemy of God's people. Well, not only did the Lord and not Barak deliver his people, but we can't miss this. He caused these great and powerful warriors, so confident in their 900 chariots of iron, to run when no man pursueth, Proverbs 28:1. That's what the wicked do. They flee and they run when no man pursueth. And the Lord caused their leader to run on foot to the tent of a woman. in all the most inopportune times to take a nap, what else could Sisera expect if he lay down when his enemies were out looking for him? He should have been less careless with his trust. Now, Deborah, in her song of victory in Judges 5, in verses 6 and 7, she even begins to sing about those days that were so horrible and so bad. She named them by the time when Jael lived. She said it was a time of great oppression, and that she, Deborah, herself, was raised up as a mother in Israel. So even in her song of praise, Deborah referred to herself as a mother. She didn't refer to herself as the president or the judge or the leader. She referred to herself as a mother with the affectionate and protective love for her children. Dr. Lockyer said, this was interesting, occasionally a strong-minded and unique woman breaks in upon history and by her exploits leaves the impact of her personality upon events and secures for herself an imperishable honor. So we ask ourselves, are we like Deborah, the mother warrior? Are we like Jael, the keeper at home with great courage and quick-wittedness, the one who stood in the doorway facing the intruder? Well, if we go back to Exodus 34:7, we're reminded of a principle as we mull these questions. Exodus 34:7, breaking in upon the verse, it says, "Forgiving iniquity and transgression of sin, and that will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and upon the children's children unto the third and to the fourth generation." We must realize that our families can be like Israel in that sin can overrun our homes and can occupy our rightful inheritance. Particularly if we've come from homes that were not Christian, should we not order our homes and post ourselves at the tent door, so to speak, to fight against our enemies? Because we must remember this verse in Exodus that the Lord forgives iniquity and He'll show mercy if we root out those besetting sins of our fathers and confess and forsake them. Should we be like Israel and fail to obey completely because of inconvenience or greed? How can Barak's example prosper our homes if we attempt to make a deal? How can that prosper us? He realized that Canaan was ruling his people, but he couldn't lead, even when he was told exactly what to do. Sometimes we may find that we're standing alone in recognizing the command of the Lord, and we're unreservedly willing to obey. But what do we do? What do we do if we don't have a leader? Do we stand as firm as Deborah and as committed as Jael? What else can we do? As we were talking earlier, how many, many people today thought that they were bringing up children, godly children. They did what they thought was right to have their children turn away. What do we do? The Lord said that He would forgive and show mercy. But we've got to root out besetting sins. Obviously, something happened for these children to go astray. Something was in the home that was causing some problem that caused these children to assume that they were angry with God or angry with His Word. How many times have we heard that? I'm just so angry. Or to become complacent. They'll get back to God when they need Him. But if we look back Do we not have sins that need to be rooted out of our families that have been perpetuated for the third and the fourth generation? Do we have anger? Do we have disobedience? Do we have pride? Do we have negotiations with the Lord? Do you look back into your parents, your grandparents, your great-grandparents? Do you know of times when they rebelled against their parents? Things that they did that have never been confessed? We've got to confess these besetting sins and turn to the Lord before iniquity will be forgiven and we will be restored. We don't want it to continue to be perpetuated in our family. So what do? We stand firm as Deborah. And we are committed as Jael. What about Jael's husband? We don't know. All we know is that she was there on her own and she did what the Lord gave her to do. But she didn't have to leave home to do it. What about Deborah? Deborah didn't give herself some assumed title. She was not usurping the place of men. She called herself a mother. And she was at home, and people came to her. So was Huldah. Huldah was at home. They went to visit her at her home. What about Esther? She was at home. What am I saying? We're not saying here that we have to be the Joan of Arc of our days, and that we have to get a vision and go out and take up a sword and lead an army and begin to fight. Deborah didn't even do that. That was Barak's job. But when Barak wasn't willing to be obedient, Deborah did what the Lord had said to do. She went with him, and she was there. And so what are we to do? If we don't have a leader, are we to throw up our hands and say, well, it's not my responsibility? What if we have a leader and the Lord chooses to remove him? Would we still stand? Would we be strong in the Lord? And what about our children and those that we hope and pray to have? Would we fight? Would we first fight in war against our own besetting sins? Those things that we maybe have nurtured and cared for and loved and cherished, and maybe we haven't really seen them to be as bad as they were, but we've forgotten that they're like 900 chariots of iron. And they will overrun us. They will be the rod that the Lord uses to chasten us with. And they will be those things that we see in our children manifested. And so those are the things that we need to discuss today as we think about what are we to do? How are we to view Deborah and Jael? They're women of strength and women of wisdom, women of obedience. But then I was asked a question, when are we to stop protecting? If we are mothers, as Deborah was in Israel, if we stand in our tent door and we protect our children when they're in our tents, so to speak, what do we do? Is there a magic age that we let them go and they go do their thing and we're no longer responsible? Well, legally there is, but what about spiritually? Eli was 98 years old and he was still held responsible for the sinning of his sons. We find in 1 Samuel 3:13-14, the Lord's pronouncement that Eli would be judged because he knew of his son's sins and he did not restrain them. So the iniquity of Eli's house would not be purged. I'm not saying that Eli should have stepped into his home and told his sons how to order his wife and grandchildren. What I'm saying is that his sons were sinning as leaders in the church over Israel in broad daylight. They were causing Israel to sin, and they were doing it without Eli's restraint or rebuke. As our children grow older, We may have to do painful things. We may have to rebuke them publicly. Will we be willing? Or will we love our children more than we love the Lord? I pray that we don't have that to happen. But if we do, we must consider that we will always be praying for our children. There's never a day that we should give them up and give them over. There's never a day that we should not be willing to speak. As Proverbs 31 says, the law of wisdom and kindness should come out of our mouths. We must know God's word, and we must be ready to apply it when it's needed for comfort, for rebuke, in our places, of course. But who else can better do it for our children than us? So we pray with Deborah then in Judges 5:31. She sang in her song of victory, "So let all thine enemies perish, O Lord, but let them that love him be as the sun when he goeth forth in his might." And the land had rest for 40 years. That's what we pray for this generation, that we might see our enemies subdued and the land have rest.